Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Lara Chan Baker.
Hello.
Hello. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action. In between client and creatives, we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the sensory deprivation tank that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we're going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing bad taste in artwork, personal infrastructure hacks, and privacy changes at Facebook. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our special guest, Kirstine Phelan, also known as KP. KP is a multi-potentialite with a deep interest in the intersection of creativity and commerce online. She's currently serving as the acting CEO for Melbourne-made startup Rome to Rio and has previously contributed to international tech via roles at Etsy, Inspire 9, General Assembly, and Startup Victoria Female Founders. She believes in good people, good products, print media, travel, music, and the power of repurposing, and I assume good podcasts as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome to the show. How are you going?
I'm really, really excited to be here, and I'm having a terrific week so far. So, you know, this is just topping it off.
I'm always really happy when someone who's on the show is also a listener of the show, because I think it just really adds something for all of us. So that is awesome, and we're so happy to have you here. And you were introed to us by Gary, who we had on the show not that long ago, old mate Gary.
That's right, Gary.
Hi, Gary. How are you, Jeremy?
I'm doing okay. There's a beeping going on at the moment.
Yeah,
it's like a bit of a telltale kind of heart situation where there's a beeping that we cannot find like the cause of. And right after this, I'm going to rip up the floorboards until I find it.
I actually like it sounds like you're joking, but I can so picture you doing that.
I absolutely would. And Lara, you are back from your kind of a, I don't know, involuntary.
I've been on my deathbed.
You've been on your deathbed.
Yeah, we're going to need to definitely like sort of, what's the word? Clean this mic after this, because otherwise someone's going to get the plague, which I definitely have 100% confirmed by Google. It's the plague.
It's great. It's making a comeback like all those other diseases we thought were gone, measles, etc.
I'm getting them all. But I have sprayed like half a thing of nasal spray up my nose in preparation for this episode. I'm ready to go. Let's do it.
Oh, so that's what you've been putting up your nose on the desk all day?
It's one of the things.
Got it. Well, I assume while you're on your deathbed, you have plenty of time to comb over the internet. So tell us about this link that you brought to us this week.
I sure will. So this comes from Topic magazine.
Sorry, what's Topic, by the way? And this is the first time.
Well, I actually want to give a big shout out to Topic, because it is quickly becoming one of my favorite places on the internet at the moment. They are this sort of tremendous online publication that creates these beautiful written visual and audio stories centered around a different theme each month. And it's sort of super diverse. It's great. And they use some wonderful illustration as well, Jeremy. For example, with this piece, like there's not only the writer that's credited, there's the photographer, the food stylist, the set designer that all collaborated to create the imagery, and I love it. Anyway, back to this particular piece at hand. It's from their crime issue and it's titled In Bad Taste. And the subheading reads, "When President Trump was seen applying ketchup to steak, the world gasped. But who says what is wrong and right to eat?" Now, I mean, personally, I'm just like really fascinated by what drives our individual palates when it comes to food or anything really. And so I kind of dove into this piece with no intention of using it for the podcast. But while I was reading it, you know, and the author's sort of thoughts on food crimes, I definitely sense there are like a lot of parallels here to art and what can be deemed good art or bad art and who actually gets to make those calls. So the writer here, he does a really wonderful job of evoking some pretty visceral food images. And a lot of these I think could be equally applied to how I sometimes feel about artwork. For example, early on in the piece, he's talking about watching some people in a sushi restaurant, two friends who are deep in this conversation about horrible boyfriends. And I just want to read from the piece here. He says, "Her friend has the last piece of salmon nigiri clenched between slivery pale wood chopsticks and is dangling it above a sauce dish, which, though shallow, shows a hefty volume of soy sauce cloudy with wasabi. I watch as the friend, focused on dispensing sympathetic outrage, lowers the rice end of her nigiri into the slurry, swabs the dish with it, rotates her wrist so the salmon tile faces down, and gives it even more swipes through the soy texture. The thing she raises to her mouth appears soaked, like a shorebird after an oil spill. She chews and goes right on talking, looking unaware that she has just done something heinous, violating the integrity of a small rectangular piece of orange-pink flesh striped with dental tape strands of connective tissue. The former food critic in me winces. This is a crime against taste."
And I do that all the time, by the way. I'm constantly putting my soy and my wasabi in the little container and dipping in my sushi tray.
am too weak to handle wasabi, but I'm like that with soy, and it made me feel a little bit bad about myself, but all right. And then he goes on to say, which I liked this whole crimes against taste aren't prosecutable, of course, but they are clear offences. By drowning a nice, fresh hunk of raw salmon in soy wasabi slurry, my table neighbour was guilty of a kind of murder. She'd killed whatever subtlety was in that fish, the faint tang of raw flesh and the mineral richness of fat. Did she even know what she obliterated in that toxic wash of salt and heat? But who can say what's better? Do crimes against food even need to be policed? Who plays cop? And should anyone, even a professional restaurant critic, dictate the terms of another's pleasure? Yelp and Instagram have remade food into a realm of boundless relativism, where extracting a thread of universal objective truth about what's delicious and what's gross can be as hard as piercing an algorithm's code, unless universal and objective are themselves the problem. My reactions to artwork aren't quite this severe, but there is definitely, I mean, an undoubtable disconnect between what different people see as great art and what they want to consume. And I don't just mean general differences in taste, because I think, you know, there are many types of artworks that I wouldn't consider my personal taste within that realm, but I can definitely appreciate why someone would love it. But there are other things that I've come across that I don't know, I just hate on a gut level, and I can't understand why someone else would see it as good. And I know that's ridiculously harsh, but it's a gut reaction that you have privately. And this led me to sort of all sorts of thoughts about what actually plays a role in determining our personal tastes in art and larger scale art trends and the positives and negatives of that. Jeremy, I want to ask you first. We are in this kind of strange position at Jackie Winter of being both like somewhat responsible, but also reactive to these trends. And I want to know, what do you think about this? What do you think drives trends, particularly in the commercial art world?
Well, this is going to be something that's going to come up in a few weeks' time. We'll talk a bit more about kind of Instagram, but obviously you can't deny that Instagram is a huge kind of, and social media in general is kind of a huge driving force to kind of all of these things. And I kind of think, yeah, this whole idea of I guess, I don't know if this is the right word, but kind of radicalization in kind of some ways. You know, like we talked about this with the YouTube algorithm, for example, how like, you know, as soon as you put something up there, there's this whole idea that it has to get, you know, something a bit more crazy and a bit more severe and a bit, and that's how people are kind of radicalized on YouTube. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot in kind of in social media as a general thing. So I think that's the thing with trends. Like you just see things kind of being taken to these kind of extremes. And again, like I think food is a great metaphor to kind of talk about, because I think, yeah, I was reading this initially and I was like, oh, what does this have to do about kind of our industry, about creativity? But you're right. It says so much about trends.
Jeremy, and I'm always right. We've talked about this.
We have kind of talked about this. I mean, I know that doesn't kind of really kind of answer your question kind of anyway, but yeah, it's definitely interesting in terms of how people, when you're trying to explore your work, I'm always talking about artists that they need to kind of find, you know, their stake and their kind of niche of kind of where they go. And when the market's kind of so crowded, it's like going into things that are traditionally kind of talked about as bad taste are probably the only place to go in that way. So like I look at an example, do you know the magazine? I think it's called A32 or 32C, sorry. It's like a German fashion magazine, and it kind of came around like 5 or 6 years ago, but they were deliberately making really controversial design choices, like, you know, horizontally stretching and squashing type, but it was done by designers, but also typically it looked kind of ugly at the same time, but it developed this kind of new aesthetic. But that was just kind of where they were kind of forced to go, because
yeah, and ugly beautiful is such a thing now, right?
Oh, of course.
It's such a trend in itself. I mean, KP, what do you see as the drivers, as you know, of your own personal taste in artwork?
That's really interesting. So as a 17-year-old coming out of Brisbane, I thought I was really cool because I was into things like Andy Warhol.
It is the cultural hub of the world.
It is, absolutely. They didn't have that great GOMA then. It was basically just the museum and whatever I could gather from my friends and from books. I was really into music. So for me, art was definitely about music. Moving to a place like, I lived in the Northern Territory for a while, so art really changed my life while I was there as well. I had a lot of exposure to Indigenous artists when I was living there, and also the idea of nature as art. I spent a lot of time alone in a desert. And when I moved to Melbourne, and I've been here for 20 years now, and I've traveled a lot during that time, I've had a couple of things that have happened. And the first one was I worked at Etsy for 4 years. And working at Etsy means you get exposed to a lot of different sort of art. I found that my tastes were highly influenced when I was working there from the artists that I was exposed to. And so I had a tendency to go for things that were more sardonic. And especially because Etsy has that craft really like backing it, I was really interested in artists who were using traditional techniques such as porcelain or, you know, latch hook. rug making or someone who was using like paper to do something that was a very modern take on very traditional crafts. So artists like Maria Rubinki, who does all of these fantastic like porcelain kids with like their heads slit open and their brain showing and, you know, they're quite shocking art pieces. I'm not saying that like that's a great thing, but the pieces themselves give you a very big emotional reaction. So that's been something that's really that exposure to Etsy and that exposure to traditional craft has been very important. And also because I travel a lot, I like to visit art experiences while I'm away. So for me, the thing that's really shifted in my view of art recently is that it's the place and how the art is presented and the contextual of everything around that, how my senses are enveloped. So a really great example is, I mean, Japan is a wonderful place. I went to the Satoshi Islands, which are the islands off the west coast near Kyoto. So Naoshima and Teshima. And Teshima has the Teshima Art Museum, which is, there's nothing in it. The art is the museum itself. And Naoshima has the same sort of thing. So I'm really more interested now in experiential and contextual art in that way.
And I
hope that was a good explanation.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's so interesting to think about why those things have come about and whether that's like, as the you know, as the context and the stages of your life shift, you become more focused. As you mentioned, sort of, you know, music was kind of where most of your art exposure came at a younger age. As you maybe like, I'm making big assumptions, but you get older, maybe you're thinking more about your own space that you live in and your own, and like, so those sort of wider spaces become more interesting. And I don't know, just sort of interesting to see how those things can reflect. There was a really beautiful part of the piece where the writer describes his introduction to dinuguan, which is a Filipino stew of mixed pork innards in a sauce of vinegar and blood.
I was actually just talking about this the other day. So it was fascinating when I saw it.
So he talks about the fact that there are plenty of dishes that appear kind of brutal, bizarre, or disgusting through the lens of culture. And he talks about how he only persisted through the meal because it was served to him by his mother-in-law and there was kind of no other option. And he talks about how happy he is that he did because he came to see the beauty in a bowl of blood and offal, you know, and a dish that looks and smells and tastes like a crime can, you know, merely be understood. It's sort of evidence of an accusing prosecutor's failure at grasping meaning or context, as he puts it. And context, of course, is a really huge factor in taste, whether you're talking food, art, music, architecture, whatever, because context encompasses all sorts of things, of course, culture, privilege, location, etc. For example, in the piece, they talk about San Francisco's famed Mission burritos, something that many people look at, you know, as crimes against good taste. These are these huge burritos that kind of have everything in them. But the context of that enormous, heavily stuffed burrito is the sort of agricultural fields of Northern and Central California, where it served this kind of portable all-day fuel for farm workers, and the fact that it adapted really well to sort of price and calorie needs of college students, whatever, it's no fault to the food itself. And often what we blast as these crimes of taste are kind of the objects of socioeconomic shaming. KP, I'm curious, like you touched on it before, and Jeremy as well, like how have your own tastes changed over time? And is there anything that you used to really love that you now look back on as bad, or are there things you like now that you never would have ever considered as interesting in the past?
That is a very interesting question. I think I've gotten more into comic art over time, and Instagram has been a really big part of that. I follow quite a few illustrators and comic artists. I'm much more into illustrative art than I ever have been previously. I've usually been more into the Yoko Ono doing some sort of like experimental thing. So I have really enjoyed comic art a lot more and illustrative art. And Instagram has absolutely been the key driver there.
Without a doubt. What about you, Jeremy?
I mean, that's a really interesting question. I mean, there are some things that, like, for example, like Morrissey is a big thing of mine. Like, you know, that was like from when I was very
young.
Didn't
you scratch Morrissey with goth ring?
I stabbed Morrissey in the wrist with a ring. It's a long story. But obviously, as I've grown and like, he has kind of espoused some kind of views that I don't think, you know, I agree with particularly. So that kind of changed taste, like, you know, the external kind of when the thing that you like actually kind of changes. Mm-hmm. But I think then also you look at something again, like tattoos as well, which is kind of like a similar thing that's all about taste. Like, it's so funny that I remember, like, you know, when tattoo artists were like kind of like on MySpace all the time. That's how people were finding work. And like everyone was just getting all this kind of work into your eyes and things that I thought were really, really cool. like I look back on now, I was like, oh my God, I'm glad I didn't see that artist for that tattoo because like, I hate their work now.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, you can look at tattoos like as a whole visual trend, like in the same way as kind of food, like, and like it becomes like a bit of parody of like what was really cool and on trend visually at one time. And I wonder, I always look at myself with my own tattoos and my own taste in general, like, you know, where are my blind spots right now? Like, what am I really into right now that I'm kind of not going to like? It's so... And when we talked about this, when we talked about millennial pink and kind of colors of the year, it's like, you know, all these things kind of happen and these trends come up and they make so much sense. But then how and why do they go? It's so interesting.
Completely. I mean, for me, like the most polite example is my own artwork. Like I look back at drawings I did in my teens that I was so unbelievably proud of. And if I saw anything equivalent now, I would absolutely dismiss it. But of course, like a big component there is that the technical skills displayed, they were really shit. So that makes some sense. But I guess one last thing I wanted to just touch on is, you know, how these ideas of good and bad art negatively impact people in the creative landscape and whether there are actually any upsides to these distinctions as well. Because I think, you know, there's a clear negative in that, like, it sort of puts people off making art potentially for fear that it's not good. There's also obviously some real sort of prejudicial biases that go into what's good, what's bad, sort of whether that's racial or gendered or whatever it might be. I'm sure a multitude of other things that are bad about it, but are there upsides? Like, you know, is it these distinctions that kind of allow artists to make big careers out of the work and allows us as Jackie Winter to kind of do the things that we do? What do you guys think?
Well, on the experiential side of things, so at one end of, in my view of taste, you have something like the Teshima Art Museum, which is a complete work of genius and art. And at the other end, you have Instagram museums, which are spaces that are set up purely for people to experience those artistic environments for the photo, not for the art itself. I look at those and there's three thoughts that come into my mind. One, super tacky. I really have never wanted to visit one, and I see people visiting them and I don't make any judgments about that person at all whatsoever, but it would not be something I would choose to do. But then I think, you know what, it makes the idea of experiential art very accessible to people who have not tried it before, particularly younger people. And also there's remuneration for artists who are creating these environments, a really great way for them to, you know, I spent a lot of time in tech, but monetize their work in a way that they can make a living from it. It could help them, you know, while they're actually working on other creative.
Instagram museums are the equivalent of the sushi drowned in soy, and people enjoy it and people make money, or there's a market for it, then why the hell not?
Yeah, exactly. You know what? I like to put wasabi all over my salmon, and who says that that is actually bad taste? Who said that I want to taste the salmon? Maybe I just want to taste the wasabi, and that salmon is just my little scooper for the wasabi. So,
boom, KP, drop the mic.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to think about because I don't know, like if I haven't used the term kind of good or bad in a while, like kind of talking about art, like I kind of think we're, you know, aren't we kind of beyond that in some ways? Like if everything is kind of so postmodern at the moment, it's not like what are you actually kind of judging that on? Like I kind of think all that kind of criteria is gone. I mean, I think you can judge kind of the craft of how a piece of work is kind of put together or if there is an idea there. Like I think it's, yeah, like I don't know, like I kind of it's so funny. It's like in food, I think, when you have like, yeah, the ingredients can be bad or kind of where you're getting it from can be bad. And then that kind of informs kind of the whole kind of badness of it. I don't know. It's
that's an interesting point of view.
Next topic.
there's a lot in there. I thought this was really interesting. I also kind of thought it is interesting to kind of explore kind of how the tools kind of change kind of these trends as well. And then kind of like how all of our cultural products are as a result of that in some way as well. And like, I was just talking to one of our artists who was here before the other day, and like we were just talking about like vector artwork and how like, well, there's only kind of so much everyone can play around with different color schemes and different proportions and everything, and then it's like you kind of run out of room in some ways. And while, you know, people talk about like typeface design, like they'll never be like, you know, why would you continue making typefaces? Like, well, why would you continue making music? It's like, well, why would you continue making art or doing any other pursuit? Like, there's always going to be these infinite permutations that you can make on those things. But I also kind of think that when it comes to trends, they're really a reflection of the tools that we have to make them. And that's why for like, we'll talk about this another time, but like for 3D, I'm seeing so much kind of 3D at the moment. And that is actually just a reflection of the tools being more available.
Yeah, without a doubt.
You know, the studio's kind of getting smaller, and that kind of is, you know, because there's more out there, create more demand for those things, and then those things kind of become the trend as well. So I think this is a great link. I'm glad you brought it to us because it just shows how all creative fields, no matter what they are really kind of linked. And it's really important to have this kind of, if you'll excuse the pun, a real broad diet of media to really...
You worked on that one, didn't you?
Just came to me. Thank you. But no, thanks so much, Laura. That's
you
a great
are welcome.
Spot. We'll move on from there. Over to me. My link this week came from another Slack group that I'm part of. I'm in a channel called hashtag Anorex. You guys know what Anorex are, what they refer to?
Yes, absolutely.
You lost me.
Well, it's a lot to do with trains.
Yes, a lot to do with trains. It's defined by...
Anorex was like a jacket.
Jumper. Yes, it is. It's, look, the Urban Dictionary definition is a person obsessively interested in a thing or topic that doesn't seem to warrant such attention. and this was specifically mentioned to me, the person who posted this. So the piece is titled Seeking the Productive Life. Some details.
This piece is very you, is all I can say.
Thank you. The piece is titled Seeking the Productive Life. Some details of my personal infrastructure. And it's written by and features on the blog of Stephen Wolfram. So Wolfram, what's Wolfram Alpha? Anyone Wolfram kind Alpha. Of familiar with this kind of? It's like, okay, so it's founded by this guy, Stephen Wolfram, and he's a British-American computer scientist, physicist, businessman. He founded the software company Wolfram Research, where he worked as a chief designer of Mathematica, which is one of their products, and Wolfram Alpha, which is like an answer engine. So it's kind of like Google on steroids. So it's kind of like it's not like a search engine that crawls their web, but it more kind of gives you these kind of answers in context.
Like using all these crazy sort of algorithms and AI technology. And it's like, I mean, Stephen Wolfram is one of our modern day geniuses, like without a doubt.
Well, and this piece digs into it a bit more. I mean, he's a modern day genius, but he's also adorable and the biggest nerd.
You can be cute and be a genius. Hey, I mean, look.
Living proof. I got there first. Sorry.
Damn it.
I read this going, wow, this guy is amazing. I've never heard of him before. And he's now my new hero. I'm thinking about getting a pin with his face on it.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, and this was a rabbit
level hole. 7,000.
There were so many other posts that it linked to in there that I thought were fantastic. And look, this isn't the first time we've covered people's life hacks, habits, etc. But look, the sheer depth, length, and I guess, I mean, thoroughness is one way to describe, just like I think makes a really fascinating read. So Stephen writes that over the years, I've been steadily accumulating and implementing personal infrastructure hacks for myself. Some of them are, yes, quite nerdy, but they certainly help me be productive. And maybe in time, more and more of them will become mainstream as a few already have. And that's what really interests me the most. And there's some really amazing systems and methods in here that I think are really worth noting. And compared to some of the more basic and well-worn, quote unquote, kind of life hacks going around today, I found the actual nerdiness of this is really refreshing. Like he's going kind of really deep. It's not kind of like, you know, inbox zero or kind of stuff like that. It's full on. So look, I mentioned length before. I counted 53 scrolls of my page down key to get through the whole article. And I just thought to discuss this thing, I just bring kind of three of my favorites kind of here.
Great.
And then I really want to get your feedback. But the first one that I wanted to draw attention to is his outside walking desk.
Unbelievable.
Probably the best photo I've ever seen.
This is the first time I've actually seen or heard someone kind of doing this, but it seems like completely obvious. So look, like many Uber nerds, Stephen espouts the benefits of the treadmill desk, and he talks about how he was 15 years ahead of the curve in kind of hacking his own together. He actually schedules his stressful calls during walking periods, another tip that I kind of really like mixed in there. And in all of Stephen's logging of personal data, he found that his heart rate was particularly lower during one period, and when he looked at the data and try to correlate it, he found that it was because he was walking outside. So basically, he adopted this stand, which is like, I don't know if you have this here, but like, you know, cigarette girls from the 20s, you know, like, you know, or kind of
like a popcorn vendor.
Yeah, like a popcorn vendor, a thing that you wear around your neck that has like a stand. And so he adapted kind of that and basically just to hold his laptop so he can work in teleconference while he was outside.
Yeah, so like a strap around his neck and
then
a little
neck,
table.
That holds
then,
the table that he
I
puts
mean,
his laptop
that's
on.
A commitment, isn't it?
Oh my God.
And that picture of him like walking in the forest.
Happy. He's just like,
My God, he's a nerd gone home. He's just happy, happy, happy. I love it.
The thing I really loved about him was I felt that like he has absolutely next leveled introversion. Like he never works in the office. He works from home. He manages a huge organization.
He's just too busy to like ever be any, like leave the office at all. But I love that he's factored in, you know, that he needs to be outside and then he needs to walk. And so, an incredible guy.
Next up is something I personally have been adhering to, like especially in the last 6 years, which is taking calls while driving. And I think as more people move further away from urban centers and especially as self-driving cars become the norm, this is actually kind of something that like, if you look at self-driving concepts, they're looking more and more like smaller offices. So I think this is going to be a really common thing. So personally for me, I moved around like 45 minutes to an hour away from our offices around 5 or 6 years ago and it had so many benefits. Now, firstly, because we have have so much international business, it means I can connect with our New York office in the morning and then our European artists or partners at night. And so especially for me with a young family, I try to make the most of work hours when I'm at the office. So that means trying to cut down on calls and meetings. And this has just been a really great solution for me. And I also find like just typically so much more focused. Like, and I think it's so easy to get distracted at the office, especially if like, you're sitting behind a screen, notifications are coming up. And with my commute, ironically, it's actually when I have the most time to focus. And of course, I pay attention to the road. I'm very, very careful. But it's one of the most focused times I have to talk, because, and it means the commute isn't kind of dead time, but actually a nice way to kind of start or bookend the day, especially if I'm advising artists or trying to give pep talks. It's like, it's a nice thing to kind of come home or start the office or start the day, you know, just feeling like I've helped someone. So I really kind of like, you know, finding ways to kind of fit work into these other natural kind of areas of my life. And it seems like that's kind of a parallel I have with Stephen, probably one of the few. But yes, I like that.
Same dress sense.
Hey. The last thing was this meta searching and kind of key logging that he's done, which I thought was fascinating. This was just the most bananas, but the one that really interested me the most. So basically, Stephen key logs everything as he types. So it's not just a matter of saving files or anything. It's like literally every time he types something, it is kind of logged somewhere. So when if you remember when Gmail launched, like they offered a similar thing, which is for emails. That's one of the most powerful thing about Gmail, I think. It's like it's just the search functionality. They took what they did for the web and kind of put it into email. And so like, you know, there's this big brain and it kind of has everything. But to have a master record of everything that you've actually typed would be so interesting to implement now, because there's so many other channels that you type things in. It's like, I don't remember. It's like, did I put something in iMessage, or was it in a Slack, or was it in my stickies? Is it in Wunderlist? It's like, it's crazy. But Stephen actually took this to the nth degree and actually digitized his entire life. So every piece of paper that, of course, he actually collected like from being a kid, he notes
that because he's never thrown anything away.
Never thrown anything away. And his family must not have either, because there's stuff in there he references like from elementary school. So he noted that it took several people years of work, but eventually all the documents were scanned. So that means there's somebody whose full time job it was to digitize his literally like his kindergarten. Oh my God, that's a whole other conversation.
Good on him.
Good on him indeed. But like, you know, he talks about this forms like his own massive archive. It's not only searchable, but like if all the computing projects that he's working on come to fruition, he posits the idea of him basically being able to be made into a bot that having, and I'm quoting here, having seen so many of my emails and being able to look at all my files and personal analytics, maybe it's actually possible to predict how I'd respond to a particular question. And now, do you remember this is literally a Black Mirror episode?
Oh, yeah.
You know, where the guy makes his...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I still love it.
Hey, I'm with you.
Fantastic. So look, there's so much to delve into here. And much of it, however, is just like really on the extreme nerd end, like especially revolving around his own company, specific ways of testing and documenting things that they're implementing. But so much of this resonated with me, especially in terms like for Jackie Winter, how we've built our own tools, like things like FileMaker and things like Corbid that, you know, we've just come across because we've faced our own needs. And that's come from my own, you know, nerdiness. And he also makes actually a really good note. I did want to add this of only adding people to LinkedIn if he's talked to them in real life.
Yes.
That's my rule.
I think I'm going to adopt it. I got to do it. I think it's fantastic.
That's a much, I do that now. Absolutely. I can't believe
isn't anyone's rule.
Because sometimes if there's someone who has a really fancy title, or like if there's someone like, yeah, you know, I don't know, like I want it for the cachet.
Also, it could be, you know, especially in the business that you're in, it could be someone that is, you know, interested in procuring your services.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, look, if it wasn't for the fact that Stephen was such a massively and successful and prolific businessman and scientist, I think some of this stuff would be a bit on the surface. Stephen states he's a person who's only satisfied if he feels he's being productive. So again, like a huge part of me really loves this. And another part of me questions like whether it's kind of a good thing. So like, I'm curious, what do you guys think? Is this a bit crazy? Where does it have merit? Is it somewhere kind of in the middle?
Well, I have some personal experience with the things that Stephen is doing. So in between working at Etsy and starting an Inspire 9, I had a 4-week break and I decided, right, I'm going to get my life together. And I invented this system called GIS to get your shit together. And it was a spreadsheet. And I split up my life into healthy, wealthy, wise, and then like relationships.
Oh my God.
So I had these four areas of concern. Mm. And I had organized. So I left Etsy in 2017. So I organized what I was going to be doing with my life all the way up to the end of 2020.
How's it going?
I'm actually on track, hey. I'm sort of on track, and like where I was going to exercise and what I was going to eat and how I was going to manage my personal relationships. Like I like booked in time to ring my mother and my nana and my auntie and my brother, my sister, blah, blah, blah. Like it was a thing of beauty.
God.
And then I remembered the very interesting thing about myself, which is I love setting up processes. businesses and really fancy things like that. And I'm terrible at actually living them. Like, I'm just a free spirit when it comes down to it.
You and many others.
I love what he's done and the fact that he's been able to accomplish this, but I need time in my life, inspiration to strike. And if it's at the same time that I've said that I'm going to call my mother, then, you know, or I don't know, I'm going to go to the gym, although it's not that. Possibly sounds like an excuse, but, you know, I need time for that to happen.
I agree. I mean, I'm so in awe of people like this. And, God, I loved this piece, Jeremy. Like, I'm just deeply jealous that some people have it in their nature to be this productive and efficient and prolific. And I bet this guy never watches Netflix for like 8 straight hours. But, yeah, just the sheer way that he speaks, it's like this beautiful balance of being so robotic but so endearing at the same time. And, yes, the article was long, but I got very engrossed in it and I just couldn't stop. And then after I finished that, I fell down that rabbit hole, Jeremy, of like other pieces he's written. It like led me to reading about the history of modern mathematics. And then at one point I spent like several hours researching and reading about some particular like Indian mathematician from the late 1800s. And then I was on like the British colonization of India and like the impact that it had on tertiary education and like a million other things. So I
did you log deep. All of that?
No, I fell very deep and I didn't sleep a lot as a result. But back to this, it was painfully esoteric at times, as you mentioned, but of course there's huge merit to this. You really do have to be a certain type of person to take any of this on in any sort of long-term way. Mm. And it kind of harks back to what we talked about with Carla McRae last time when we were talking about work life hacks, whatever, which is that, you know, unless it actually aligns with your individual personality and behaviors, then yeah, these things can be kind of pointless. But I take this article as a fascinating insight into who Stephen Wolfram is, more than as an instructional, as well as, you know, taking away, I guess, a general sentiment of being more active in the way that I design my life, my thoughts, my goals, my education, etc., in a way that works for me. And yes, there is, I think, huge merit in his insanity because it works for him, and my God, it is a beautiful thing. There was one, like, some of these things seem so insanely like granular, but they do actually speak to how kind of basic design decisions can majorly affect a working environment. Like one that I kind of liked was like, for example, like the drawers that he uses to store papers in. Each drawer has this little gap at the top so that he doesn't actually have to open the drawers to put something in. He can just slide it on through, right? Now, as a time-saving concept, that's kind of nutty, but when you combine 100 of those small things into an office or living space, they add up to like a pretty significant difference in how your daily duties play out. So that was kind of interesting. But I think what really stuck out to me is I just feel like there's no way on earth that Wolfram could have achieved and produced all of the unbelievable number of things that he has and clearly will continue to without living a life like this. Mm-hmm. Like this became, I think, just particularly clear to me when he was talking about his filing systems, both physical and digital, and just the sheer number of things that he appears to be involved in and thinking about it at any given time demands a level of organization that would be ridiculous for, you know, you or I, you know?
Oh, I feel like I've completely like, I feel now this, I essentially am just like
it's not
like
us. It's not who great. We are. It's not who we're driven to be. But without it, he would be a quarter of the man he is now.
Interesting.
Well, okay, let's talk about, I mean, automation as well, because a lot of this does come down to automation, mm-hmm. which like when we talk about life hacks, like it actually don't really kind of see much kind of technical data on this, but it's kind of something that I think is, yeah, a really kind of big part of his system. You mentioned the GIST system you created.
Which was terrible.
But I mean, tell me, like if you could automate one area of your life, either work or personal, mm-hmm. what would it be and why? Or yeah.
Absolutely. I know exactly what I would do. It would be like my personal nanny, which would make me go, it would basically set my appointments for me, put it in my calendar, block it out, not let anyone block over the top of it, and then force me to go. So that would be optometrist, gynecologist, doctor, you know, my business coach, the dentist, laser, nails, hair. There's a lot
and pay for
do.
All that as well.
Yeah, I mean, and if it was all like repay, yeah. It was all like just I didn't have to, if I just walked in, did what I had to do. Yeah. And then, I mean, that would be great, wouldn't it? I feel like that's a different story though. Yeah. But yeah, if someone was just like managing that part of my life for me, tax, like it's just stuff that I know I need to do, but I just have this real problem with making appointments.
Yeah, I feel you. Because like for me, it would be like food, right? Like I love to cook. I love to eat. I know what I should be eating and I don't mind eating healthily. But you get busy and it's a whole fucking thing. And I've tried various ways. Like I did Marley Spoon and I get like now at the moment I do get some like U Foods and stuff, or like I've done like getting like online orders from Coles and whatever else. Mm. But it's just, I want more than that. I want beautiful recipes that are far better than like any of your like Marley Spoon or whatever is going to give you, right? That I want Some already made, but they taste not like they've been already made. They taste like they're fresh. Some that are set up ready for me to start cooking and I don't have to think about it at all. They're just in my fridge and ready to go. That would be like my dream, which is basically like personal chef and shopper.
Personal shopper.
So I just need to get rich is basically it. But yeah, Jeremy, I'm with you. Like for me, the meta searching stood out to me as the most remarkable element of everything here. Like even if it's in, you know, the minute way comparably to like what he's doing, I absolutely need to integrate more of this sort of action into my life. I mean, like I am, as we have talked about before, I am a voracious reader and researcher, and I get an enormous amount of pleasure from doing those things, but I have the most heinous memory, like a memory of a goldfish with Alzheimer's. It's so bad. And I mean, I can barely remember what I ate for breakfast, and I'm not being like funny when I say that, like I've forgotten huge chunks of my life that many would consider milestones, and taking in so much information is enjoyable, but it's sad to know that I just kind of lose it again, you know? And I would love to have a proper filing system, putting these things away that I've read or written or heard or whatever, so that I can easily search, you know, some tag later and find it. And of course, you know, not just a system of actually storing the stuff, but then a regular practice of searching those storages and reviewing the content so that I'm actually making use of what's in there. Like I already do use Evernote, Pocket, cloud-based documents, email, et cetera, to sort of hang on to almost everything. But the next step is developing a good system for both filing stuff and then finding it again. Like my Evernote tags are so many different things that I wouldn't even know what tag to search. It's like kind of a pain because I loved how he talked about keeping his filing categories really broad and simple. Like they have to be few enough that you know what the categories are and broad enough that you don't have trouble deciding where something should go. And I just think the way that he writes about this is so brilliant. Like if we had time, there are so many excerpts that I would love to read out here about his actual filing methods, but I think Jeremy would kill me. So I'm just going to say they're intense.
And everyone should read them.
But amazing. And everyone should read them. But yeah, of course, there's also the actual meta searcher, right? Like at the top of his homepage, he has that search box into which he can type anything like rhinoceros, and he'll immediately find every email he's ever sent or received in the past 30 years in which rhinoceros has appeared, as well
probably
as,
many.
Exactly. As well as like every file in his machine, every physical paper document in his archives. And that is so mind-blowing to me. Like imagine like actually being able to access and utilize all of the information you've ever come across. Like I can't actually express properly how this makes me feel inside. Like I got giddy reading it.
I think I'd be terrified because that brings us back to the taste question.
Well, look, it's always so interesting how all our links end up kind of coming together because KP, we're about to go into kind of Facebook and privacy and all these other things. And I think if you look at Stephen as someone who's been kind of so ahead of his time, it requires not only a huge amount of personal discipline, but huge technical mastery to do what he's done. And so a lot of this kind of, we are now either willingly or unwillingly are having kind of our data kind of now tracked by different people. And in some ways, like I love it when I get in my car and it tells me automatically how long it's going to take me to get home when I never put in anything in my calendar or even knew that I want, like I didn't even know I was going home or anything. So it's like these kind of weird things happen. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where it goes. Laura, you want to close this out?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention like some last things here. I mean, of course, like this critical thing behind his meta searcher is that he's stored so much stuff in a way that's able to be trawled through digitally, right? But things like Evernote actually do allow us everyday plebs to do this kind of thing on some level, right? Mm-hmm. Like I already use it really heavily for things like recipes. So for example, I might search like vegetarian and weeknight and quickly like a bunch of relevant things pop up that I have saved that I know I like. And, you know, I use it a lot for vocabulary. Like I years ago started popping like kind of unfamiliar or interesting words and their definitions and their use cases and etymologies into Evernote with various tags. And I would like go back every now and then and review things. And as a writer, it was just like an interesting thing for me. But one paragraph in particular really drove this home for me. And the idea of sort of being able to really maximize your learning and therefore your outputs, right? So he says, I'm amazed by the amount of even quite ancient personal history that I seem to encounter practically every day. Some person or some organization will contact me and I'll look back at information interactions I had with them 35 years ago, or I'll be thinking about something and I'll vaguely remember that I worked on something similar 25 years ago and look back at what I did. I happen to have a pretty good memory, but when I actually look at material from the past, I'm always amazed at how many details I've personally forgotten. So like to put this into some perspective, it occurred to me while I was typing up my notes for today that like I've kept all my personal notes for every one of our 74 podcast episodes in this one Google Doc, right? So there are now 293 pages of notes documenting all of the thoughts and ideas I've ever had when researching like each topic for the show over five and a bit seasons. And just like as a test, I was using the sort of basic find function, just like Command F, to search terms like AI or feedback or whatever it is. And I came across these things that I barely even remember writing, but which would be really useful for me for any of like the, I don't know, talks I sometimes give or articles I write or whatever else. And it was just like, it was a very weird feeling and just further confirmed for me like how life-changing a system like this could be for someone like myself.
That's really interesting. You know, I use Pinterest, which is great. It's just like a visual version of that, like links to all sorts of different things.
Like Pocket as well.
Yeah, Pocket's really good as well. Yeah,
I can't wait to put this all together in the Jackie Winter Supercut edition that, you know, is surely going to come out at some point in the future. Thank you so much for your feedback on this. Such a really interesting article. It'll be in the show notes as always. But yeah, really encourage you to check this one out and we'll move on from there. As we do in every show, we end up with our special guest, KP. First time that Facebook is coming into focus here for us. But before we get into your link, something I like to ask everybody is like, tell us a bit about your internet hygiene. Kind of where do you get your news from? What do you like to read? Where do you find your links?
So being the forgotten generation member that I am, it means that email still actually has a really important part of my reading habits.
Hey, me too.
So if I like a website, I will subscribe to their newsletter so I can get the digests. I read this new newsletter called The Morning Brew, which has come out of NYC, which I like because it is a mix between tech and financial reporting, which is really fantastic. I can keep on top of things pretty clearly there. And I do spend a little bit of time on Twitter for the travel industry that I'm in. So I'm in the travel technology industry. I read Skift and I read Focuswire, which are two really clear industry publications. Mm. Also just random, like Rome to Rio has a very active random and Goodreads channel. Mm. Often people will post things in there and I'll go on a little, just that little slide into the internet.
Yes. It's my favorite way to spend the day.
So yes, I did share both these links and everyone was getting very excited about Wolfram. I was like, he's epic. And also I do a roundup for the staff. I used to do it about once a month, but I haven't really been so great the last couple of months, but I do a roundup about interesting links that I've found. So I have a tendency just to sort of like read broadly. I subscribe to a lot of newsletters and I put aside time in my day to read certain newsletters at certain times of the day or the week.
And so tell us about this link. I mean, why did you pick it?
Well, I really think that Wired does fantastic technical reporting. So that's the number one reason. I think they're breaking news all the time. Secondly, Wired in particular are very unfriendly to Facebook. If you listen to any of the Wired podcasts, they will come out saying, we think Facebook is doing the wrong thing at the moment in a very editorial way. But I chose this because, and the link I chose was the news that Chris Cox, who has been the head of product at Facebook, is leaving. Now, the reason why I chose it is A, he's been at Facebook for 13 years, which means he's been in creative partnership with Mark Zuckerberg for 13 years. So in this article, it's quite short, but it does sort of give you a really great overview of what impact Chris has had within that company. So I like that about the article. Also,
it already was like one of the first 15 engineers hired or something.
That's right.
Like,
he's one of the first 15 engineers. And also it links off to the manifesto that Zuckerberg published the other day. And it also links off to a couple of other Wired opinion pieces. So it's a good place to start if you're looking into this story. The reason why I thought it would be really great for Jackie Winter is because A, there's that creative partnership. Two, the other thing that's really interesting is that they're going to split up the way that the organization is structured. So Chris was reporting into Mark and WhatsApp, Instagram and Facebook were all unified under his leadership. Now they'll be split into three again.
That was fairly recent in itself, wasn't it?
That happened. Chris resigned. I think all of that sort of happened around the same time. Mm. So this is what it says to me is that Chris Cox has been a big part of Facebook. He's been instrumental in the early days of the news feed. He's been instrumental in things around privacy filters, around news bubbles, around responding to all of the criticism that Facebook has received. And often by moving in the direction of transparency. Now, Mark is moving in the direction of let's shut everything down and make everything into sort of like privacy. Of course, there'll always be the social town square part of off Facebook. But I mean, really, will there? Because it's becoming a bit of a ghost town anyway when you get into your newsfeed. So if it's going to be going in that privacy, it seems to me that there's been a very big creative conflict here. How do we deal with creative conflicts? And I think it happens a lot in many businesses. And the third thing, of course, is just privacy. So, you know, Facebook is moving into privacy. They're going to be doing end-to-end encryption. They're going to be doing all of these sorts of things. Do we even trust them to be able to do that after everything that they have done with our data?
Very, very valid question.
So
right?
That's sort of like the three things for me that have really popped up. The idea of creative partnerships, going in different directions, splitting up their org, and can they actually pull this off?
I got such big questions there because, like, I have to admit, I honestly somehow missed the whole, like, manifesto, all 3,200 words of it. I don't know where I was or, like, what I was doing.
I think that was when the plague was having a
that
moment.
That could be it because it completely passed me by. But I have been reading up for this episode, of course. And yeah, I mean, as they note in the article, it's hard to say whether it is a sort of genuine shift in practice and philosophy or if it's just kind of a new business strategy for them. But what we do know is, yeah, as you said, over the past 15 years, Facebook has kind of prioritized growth over privacy and now they're massively, they're pivoting, right? Another article on Wired that they linked to put it really well. Mark Zuckerberg, now 34, a public figure attacked relentlessly in the press and by politicians around the world, has seen his company get burned for ignoring user privacy. And he's seen the platform that he built to make the world more open and connected can also be used by harassers, racists, trolls, bullies, and Vladimir Putin. His company's reputation has faltered. Growth on the main platform has slowed and employee morale has dropped. And so a few weeks ago, he published his manifesto laying out a privacy-focused vision for the company. In Zuckerberg's words, public social networks will continue to be very important in people's lives for connecting with everyone you know, discovering new people, ideas and content, and giving people a voice more broadly. But now, with all the ways people also want to interact privately, there's also an opportunity to build a simpler platform that's focused on privacy first. And yeah, I mean, in the post, like he made this sort of litany of promises about, as you said, enhancing encryption on Facebook, Instagram, keeping servers out of like authoritarian countries where leaders might seek to spy on their citizens, and reducing the sort of permanence of messages or stories, which he had as a feat, like a function for himself for ages anyway.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
I know, right? Because yeah, I mean, no one wants their bong photos coming up when they're applying for jobs. Yes, also described in detail how they're going to sort of integrate those three messaging platforms, Facebook Messenger, Instagram Direct, WhatsApp. So they're sort of interoperable but not merged, and talking so much about end-to-end encryption and messaging, which is like the major focus here. And there is this idea that the social network of the future won't be one where everyone connects openly together as in this kind of town square that you've mentioned, but it'll be one where more connections happen sort of one-to-one as in a living room. And instead of data permanence, data will disappear. And that is a huge U-turn for Facebook and definitely puts the whole kind of newsfeed idea into question. Like Zuckerberg actually did an interview with Wired shortly after the manifesto was released, which is kind of interesting. At the start of the interview, he's like, thanks for speaking to me for a few minutes. And then it's quite long. I'm like, how did they cover this in a few minutes?
He talks pretty quickly.
Clearly. I mean, I'm one of them. Where yeah, they got to ask him a few crucial questions. I can't say the answers were that satisfying. Did you read that interview?
I think that he has been media trained into a point where has his key points. He won't go past his key points. And, you know, I think it's actually a hallmark of all interviews with Mark Zuckerberg.
Have you seen Get Out, like the movie?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, when like at some points the people like start saying stuff like their real selves are like coming out and able to, that's how I felt reading it. I was like, Mark desperately wants to like say something, but he's been like, cased in this layer of like false, I don't know, I'm reading too much into this. But at one point the journo actually asked that exact question, like, does the newsfeed still exist with all these changes? And the short version of Zuckerberg's answer was like, yes, but the full answer is kind of flimsy and not really that revealing because I actually don't think he even knows.
I don't think he would at this point.
No, we're at this really pivotal point in this kind of backlash against Facebook and these sort of town square social media platforms. It's just like really hard to say where things might go.
Well, I think one of the things that causes me the most concern is the idea of, okay, we're going to move from town square into lounge room or public hall environments. So the idea of a private Facebook group. Now, Facebook has had enough problems in like trying to remove bad actors from their site when they can see everything that's going on. How will they be able to cope with bad actors, for lack of a better term, when you're in an encrypted environment? How are they going to deal with those unseen bubbles?
And they already know because WhatsApp's encrypted, right? And they have huge trouble with policing that kind of thing on WhatsApp. Like, I guess, yeah, for all its criticism, data collection has its benefits. Like, it allows them to track and moderate this kind of dangerous content. And like, one Wired journalist put it really well. Like, he made the point that if Russian intelligence operatives had just used private encrypted messaging to manipulate Americans, would they have been caught? Mm. And like, that's a really valid point. Jeremy, what do you think about all this?
It's really interesting. I mean, I kind of, like, as I'm trying to kind of also think about how this kind of relates to our artists and kind of like our work, like, I'm always trying to kind of put those things in together. And like, I just think like Facebook has just become kind of too big. And like, whether it's kind of gets split up by what they're trying to do themselves, or whether it kind of gets split up by regulation. It's, you know, I think that's just kind of the natural way that it's obviously going in that direction. And, you know, people leaving is kind of all part of that. Like, you know, the actual structure of the business is kind of breaking up like that.
Yeah, because there were other structural changes as well, not just Chris, which were sort of kind of interesting, none of which I can remember right now, but they were kind of
on that relationship, I think it's really important. That is a key creative partnership that is breaking up. So does that work in the creative industry? What's some examples of like key creative partnerships that have broken up, perhaps like on the back of a change?
I think, I mean, it happens all the time in ad agencies, you know, where like an ad agency, like literally, if you look at kind of ad agencies are typically initials of the founders' names, and as they kind of come together with new people, the names change and then they break up and they, you know, there's always that kind of...
Well, like Horaf that we're talking about last week, which is a much more like amicable, lovely sort of example of this, but where these incredible sort of design studio founders realize that their visions for the future of the studio and of their careers and their lives were different, and they decided to call it quits before it became bad, you know? Mm. And I think these things do happen often.
Yeah, I think that was one of the most interesting parts of the article for me, is that like there's lots of kind of, I mean, you mentioned before that Wired is very kind of critical of kind of Facebook. And I always have to kind of take these criticisms with grains of salt, because you never know kind of like what kind of biased information you're getting to. I mean, this goes into the whole fake news thing. But yeah, that's it's so interesting to kind of think about like, well, yeah, why do they kind of have this kind of certain perspective? But I also like that they broke apart kind of, they found this kind of coded language and how they were talking about the products. And you need someone to decode that, though. And there is a lot of kind of subtext there. In terms of, you know, trying to figure out like, yeah, why is kind of somebody leaving? And like, and you always have to kind of read between the lines. You talk about advertising and like when accounts kind of, you know, come and go from different agencies, like, you know, that creates a huge kind of cultural change. And I love reading, you know, the lines of, you know, need to spend more time with their family, and then that kind of what it actually means.
And you find out from a mate somewhere that like it was, yeah, they got fired for harassment or something. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's only fair that many people weren't too sure what to make of this kind of big announcement, both the leaving and the changes in the privacy, because I mean, how much of it is, as we said, this kind of real shift? How much is it is just like a new business strategy? And like Zuckerberg even acknowledged in the post, he was said like, I understand that many people don't think Facebook can or would even want to build this kind of privacy focused platform, because frankly, we don't currently have a strong reputation for building privacy protective services. And yeah, I mean, like their relentless pursuit of data has led to some pretty full-on accusations over the years. But I think like one thing that is really key to note is that in all of these 3,200 words, Zuckerberg failed to touch on how Facebook plans to actually approach data sharing and ad targeting in this kind of privacy focused future.
Yes, exactly. Because if you even look at the way that the WhatsApp and the way that they make money, like they're not really
making money.
Machine.
That's it.
So I think like...
And their power is data, and that data is money. Like, yeah.
It's a very, very, very big shift.
It's a different business. Like, and if they are actually committing to doing these things, like, arguably the primary issue that plagues them is this kind of data collection and any abuses there. Like, no one's forgotten about Cambridge Analytica and whatever else. And, you know, these sort of loose policies on data collection over the years are also what has allowed them to build like the most successful targeted advertising business in history. You know, and like with all of this now in question, it still hasn't been really sort of adequately addressed, because yeah, privacy comes at a cost. By prioritizing privacy, they're forced to deprioritize other things.
That's right. So I'm not sure how they're going to make a go of this, which I find interesting, which is,
and
imagine,
they asked him point blank and he just didn't really have much to say.
And I imagine that if we think like what's happening in the boardroom of Facebook, that would be a conversation between Mark Zuckerberg and Chris Cox that didn't go well and has ended up in something like this. The other thing I found really interesting about this was that I had always thought that Sheryl Sandberg would be next in line to be the CEO at Facebook, just because she's so present. She's involved in all the conversations. Mm-hmm. She's very widely seen and spoken about. I've rarely heard of this person prior to this, even though he's been so instrumental in the company. And I don't know if that's because my focus lies, but I thought it was really interesting that this product and technical leader was the person that was going to possibly the next CEO after Mark.
Yeah, completely. I think while we wrap up, there are just a couple of last things that are really worth mentioning. One thing I found particularly interesting that harks back to a lot of the stuff we talk about here is what it might do to the company's efforts in artificial intelligence. Like, they've spent years building systems that are, you know, crucial to many elements of the way that they work. And AI needs as much data as possible to give the best results. So, you know, like Google, they've long been one of the few in such a position to take advantage of crazy amounts of data. So it looks like there might be some trade-offs for Facebook, for them in this area down the track, right? Mm. If they're restricting that data flow. But that said, we also know that Facebook have been working secretly on some very big blockchain initiatives. Who knows what they are? But this swing towards privacy as the kind of be all and end all might have something to do with the benefits of pushing people towards encrypted systems.
Mm,
who knows? They have to think about business in the end. And lastly, to bring it back to like how it actually affects some of us, I think it's really interesting to look at how this might affect media and the news industry, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because like Facebook have this kind of weird love-hate relationship with news business, Wired included. And, you know, the media like relies on Facebook for distribution, but also resents it for swallowing up all the ad business and like kind of all the money that comes with that. And even if the news feed sticks around, it's with this sort of encryption sort of stuff, right? With this sort of privacy, increased privacy, it means likely that there's distribution potential for publishers on Facebook will decline, right?
Absolutely.
Less data is used to target people. But on the other hand, if Facebook is actually pivoting to some sort of as yet unknown new business model, then perhaps advertising might revert back to media outlets, which would be interesting. Who knows? We can only speculate.
Very, very interesting as well. And yeah, I think for artists as well, like in terms of what they use Facebook for, in terms of just kind of putting your artwork out there and just kind of building an audience. Like, I kind of think there's this one diagram I need to kind of find, which is so interesting, which kind of showed how they took a screenshot of Craigslist from like, you know, 2000, and basically how every section of Craigslist has now kind of siphoned kind of their own business, you know, so jobs went to Glassdoor or kind of apartments went to Airbnb, things like that. And I think you're going to see the same thing with kind of Facebook. So I think it's really worth like,
because I always think like the only reason I keep Facebook is for events.
Everyone has
their own
reason.
There's got to be another reason.
Yeah.
And I mean, another way.
And I think creators and artists like, you know, need to kind of be bold and kind of like finding that, because I think that's the only way that, you know, this shift is going to happen. So lots of really interesting things to pick apart in a deceptively short article. So KP, thank you so much for bringing up that. Lara, thank you so much as well.
No worries.
Before we wrap up for the week, it is time for our favorite segment, the brilliantly named thumbs up / thumbs down / shaka, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, and the completely radical off of our chest. Laura, what do you got for us this week?
Ooh, my thumbs up this week comes from a Facebook group that I'm in called Wait a Minute, This Is Not Flavortown, Where the Heck Am I? Which is basically just like weird posts about fucked up food. I just thought it linked really nicely to the article I brought this week, because this woman posted about her sister and it had me feeling all kinds of ways, and I just have to read it to you. She said, "My little sister, who is still grown as hell, I might add, has never learned to cook anything in her life. Here are some of the things I've caught her making for dinner when I'm at my mum's house. One, she got a bag of frozen blueberries, poured them into a bowl and microwaved them until they were hot and mushy, then ate it plain with a spoon."
I would do that. I would do that.
Blueberry soup. She cooked two,
I love it.
She cooked two baked potatoes, took out all the insides and threw those away, ate just the skin with butter on it. She ate something called a deconstructed sandwich. She put bread, lunch meats and cheese in a circle on a plate, then piled mayonnaise in the middle to dip them all in, claims it's no different. She made a fruit smoothie that was warm grapes, warm water and a little bit of ice. I asked her if she wanted some almond milk or yogurt or sugar or different fruit, and she said she was fine with warm grapes and water. And lastly, and probably the most heinous, she cooked spaghetti noodles, smothered them in butter and parmesan cheese, then put them in the refrigerator. Waited like an hour until they were hard and stuck together, then pulled them out of the bowl in one whole solid chunk and ate it like that."
She is absolutely pushing the boundaries of what you can do with food.
I mean,
so
yeah, she's
to be applauded. She's to be applauded.
I used to do like, oh man, yeah. Actually, I'm not going to even talk about that. KP, what do you got for us? Thumbs up, thumbs down, sucker.
I actually have a thumbs up, and my thumbs up is for being taught about line spacing on Google Slides. Shout out to Andrew G, who is our product head at Rome to
I'm
Rio.
I'm guessing that's a different Andy G to like the one that is now Osher Gunsberg and who used to be on Australian
very
Idol.
Different.
Damn.
Very, very different. But he was helping me with some slides yesterday and he was like, oh, I think that you've got some problems with the spacing there. He said, just do this and do this. And I discovered line spacing and how you can actually use it for good. And that's my really exciting thing that I got really obsessed on line spaced everything.
We're excited for you too.
Yeah. I'm not exactly like, I love visual things, but I'm much better with my hands than with a digital tool.
Jerry, what about you? What you got?
I've got a thumb. Are we triple thumbs up here? This
week? My goodness.
Mine can easily be a thumbs down.
Yours is a 100% thumbs up.
My thumbs up is for forgetting about TV for a bit and then remembering it again.
Oh,
so,
what? Live to air TV?
A specific show. So one of my favorite shows ever is High Maintenance. So you know when you're watching Game of Thrones and you watch it leaves you on a cliffhanger, you're just like, oh, I can only binge the whole thing, but you can't. Anyway, so with High Maintenance is another episodic show, probably my favorite on HBO as well. And a whole season came and went and I didn't even know it was on. And now the whole thing is available and done. And so now I can binge it. So there you go. Forgetting
about
TV. That's
my move, Jeremy.
That's very cool.
My thumbs up. KP, if people want to find out more about you on the internet, Rome to Rio, any of that stuff, where should people go?
If you want to find out more about Rome to Rio, which is helping people get from A to B all around the world, you go to RomeToRio.com.
That's number two.
That's Rome as in the city to the numeral Rio as in RioDeJaneiro.com. And if you want to find out more about me, it's my first name, last name at Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn.
Awesome. And we will put all
Medium.
And can't forget Medium. We will put links to all those in our show notes. So don't forget it. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
I've had a great time. It's really, really good. So thank you so much for inviting me on.
Thank you.
I'm Jeremy Wartzman. She's Laura Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more JWGYTB, archives of all of our shows and the links we cover can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And if you want to receive all the links we talk about on the show each week in one neat little package, sign up to our recently redesigned newsletter, which is all things Jackie Winter, all things podcast, all together in one lovely sandwich. The sign-up address is jwg.is/newslettering. Again, jwg.is/newslettering. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter, that's Jackie with a Y, and Winter like the season, and hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you're listening to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, Castro, Apple Podcasts, you'll be able to see links to the articles as we're talking about them, as well as other visual content as we go on. And finally, if you work for an ad agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.radio for more info. Thank you for listening. We'll catch you all next week. Thank you very much again. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you. Bye. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our very special guest, Kirstine Phelan. Also, I'm going to say it again.
Yep.
You see, as soon as someone mentions something about a name and it gets stuck in my head about the name, I always fuck up.
Yeah, the Risco Goal episode. I'm having
Oh, God, that was terrible. Let me do that one more time.